Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It is a dreary and drippy November day, and I am out at the Mines of Spain near Dubuque, and I'm with New York Times bestselling author Heather Gudenkauf. We're out on a trail that is familiar territory to people who live in Dubuque and hike out at the Mines of Spain. It's also familiar territory to people who have read Heather's latest novel, Not a Sound, which tells the story of nurse Amelia Wynn, who is injured by a hit-and-run driver, loses her hearing, and then spirals into depression and alcoholism. Toward the beginning of the novel, she is starting to rebuild her life and hopefully rebuild her relationships. And she is out on a paddleboard on the river and makes a terrible discovery, a dead body. And this is where things start. And Heather, thank you so much for taking me out to the Mines of Spain today.
And I'm so happy to be able to share this beautiful piece of Iowa with you.
And we're going to go for a little hike, but tell me, this is a place where you spend a lot of time. Is this where inspiration for this latest novel came from?
Absolutely. Yes, I spend a lot of time hiking this area with my dog, Lolo. And when I do go walking, the setting, the atmosphere really lends itself to being creative. And I get a lot of my ideas while I'm out here. And especially with my latest novel, Not a Sound, I was walking this very path, and the vision of Amelia and her situation really began to develop. And I came back many times as I was writing the novel and just trying to capture the beauty, the solitude of the area. And it really, really helped set the atmosphere for the book.
Well, let's walk while we talk. The time that Amelia spends in nature in the book, it's something so familiar to me. And I imagine something that's so important to you. But it seems kind of strange given the situation she's in. She is deaf and had been hearing before. So she's spent 2 years of her life isolated from the life she had before, but she's still seeking this solitude. Does that heighten the predicament she's in to you, the fact that she spends so much time alone?
I think so. And I think for Amelia, she is trying to reclaim her life, though she knows it will never quite be the same as she once had it. I mean, she was an emergency room nurse. She was married. She was raising a stepchild. And she lost that. And, you know, she was deafened due to the accident, but that wasn't why she lost her family and her livelihood. It was how she handled it. And she did go into this self-isolation mode for a long time. And I think the wilderness was a safe place for her to start dipping her toe, I guess you'd say, back into the real world. And she wasn't really alone. She had has her service dog Stitch with her, who provides really the sense of hearing for her. And so I think it just gave her an opportunity to begin to explore the world and what she felt like was a safe place. Unfortunately, it didn't quite turn out that way for her.
Amelia finds so much solace in nature. And really at the beginning of the novel, she's not just rebuilding her life, but you can feel her building her muscles and rebuilding her ability to be independent. And that time in nature seems like a very important piece of that puzzle.
Yeah, I think for her, it's therapeutic, and it gives her the time to think and, you know, plan how she is going to rebuild her life. It gives her something to think about besides her loss of her hearing, the loss of her family, and dealing with it with alcohol. And so yeah, I think that she really becomes one with nature and relies on many of her other senses while she's out there.
Your books have always taken place in fictionalized locations. Yes. And this one does too. I mean, the names have been changed. Mm-hmm. But it's on your home turf. It's really clearly that it's Dubuque, and this is the area around Dubuque where so much of the action takes place. Why did you decide to place it here?
You know, I just love my hometown. I've lived here for over 20 years, raised my children here with my husband, and I think it was just the perfect setting for this novel. And in fact, I got the idea really for the novel. I was out paddleboarding with some friends over in Galena, Illinois, and it was completely isolated, nobody around. And we saw a man standing on the side of the river digging a hole. And we all looked at each other, and I'm sure it was completely innocent what he was doing, but we looked at each other and said, "That's the idea for your next novel." And it was. And I knew exactly the kind of setting that I wanted. And I also sprinkled many different locations from Dubuque into the book as well, fictionalized, of course.
So, yeah, how did you use the place as a catalyst to creativity?
You know, I it's hard to explain, but when I'm out here hiking, and I spend a lot of time at Swiss Valley Nature Preserve as well, it's just a great place to let your imagination run wild. You can feel like you're all alone and in the middle of nowhere and just be a few miles from town. And it just felt right for this novel. And I knew I wanted to set a book clearly in Dubuque, and this was just the right one to do.
Why didn't you call it Dubuque?
You know, I think as a writer of fiction, I wanted to be able to have that little bit of leeway to change things up a little bit and have it be okay if the location of the spot that I'm describing isn't exactly where it is in the city in Dubuque. So I have a little bit of freedom with that, but also know that it's fun for the people in the area to recognize those spots.
So you have such dark things happen in your novels, and it's hard to imagine coming up with these ideas for dangerous situations that happen, very dangerous, very scary situations that happen, and then coming out into the woods to try to flesh it out. Tell me a little bit more about how that feels.
You know, I don't scare too easily.
And clearly not.
No. And I have my trusty sidekick, Lolo, my German short hair pointer, who's usually my constant companion as I go hiking. And I just have never felt scared and really let my imagination run wild, but I've never felt that way myself.
Did the fact that you placed these people in your community, in the places where you spend time, does that make them even more real?
I think so. I think so. We passed back there a little bit, really, which the piece of nature, the part of Catfish Creek where I really envisioned where the crime took place. And whenever I walk past there, you know, that is on my mind, that this was visually the inspiration for the book.
So you were a teacher. You still work in the school system. This feels like a very interesting dual life that you lead, writing suspense thrillers, helping children learn to read.
Yes. Well, I'm really, really fortunate that I get to do two things that I love to do. I'm not in the classroom anymore, but I do support our reading programs for the Dubuque schools. And I love that I can do that. And because reading for me growing up was so important. And I'm so happy that I can, in a small way, keep contributing to that. And I love to write. I love writing. I love the creativity that comes with it, building a story from ground up. So I find myself very, very lucky.
We've got another beautiful view here looking down. Is this also part of Catfish Creek?
This is all part of Catfish Creek, which spills into the Mississippi. It connects down the way. And yeah, this runs all the way through into Dubuque and out to actually Swiss Valley, which is another one of my stomping grounds.
Do you find that you need to be alone in nature? Is this something that sort of builds up in you when you can't get out?
Absolutely, yes. I when people talk about writer's block and not being able to come up with ideas or continue, that does happen. And for me, one of the ways that I, work through it is to come out and walk and start letting ideas kind of flow over me and different scenarios. And for me, it makes a big difference. It really seems to unblock some of the challenges when I hit a difficult part in a novel.
Is there a kind of a ritual that you need to go through to get what you need to get out of this time?
I don't know if I'd call it a specific ritual. I just is making the time to do it and to come out here. It's something that I do as much as I can whenever my schedule allows. And, there isn't anything set in stone that I have to do or certain places I have to go. I just have to go and walk and look around and just let the thoughts and ideas kind of simmer until something comes to me.
Well, thank you for sharing this walk with me.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming along with me.
I can imagine so much more clearly now, so many of the scenes in the book.
Wonderful.
Which makes, I'm not scared right now, but it's still a little freaky. We're going to continue our conversation in a few minutes in the nice, warm, dry Dubuque Public Library. You are listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm talking with bestselling author Heather Gutenkopf.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. After New York Times bestselling author Heather Gutenkopf and I went for a short hike at the mines of Spain, we went to the Carnegie Stout Public Library in Dubuque to have a conversation in front of a live audience. Heather started off with a reading from her latest suspense thriller, Not a Sound, a pivotal moment from the book that takes place in a location very similar to where we went for our hike.
I come upon what is normally my favorite part of Five Mines, a constricted slice of river only about 15 yards wide and at least 20 feet at its deepest. The western bank is a wall of craggy limestone topped by white pines and brawny oaks whose branches extend out over the bluff in a rich bronze canopy of leaves. Today, the river is unusually slow and sluggish, as if it is thick with silt and mud. The air is too heavy, too still. On the other bank, the lacy leaf tendrils of black willows dangle in the water like limp fingers. Laying a hand on Stitch's rough coat, damp from his swim, I feel him tremble beneath my fingers. I follow his gaze and find myself staring down to where a thick layer of fallen leaves carpets the surface of the water, a vibrant mosaic of yellows, reds, and browns. There's nothing there, I tell him, running my hand over his ears and beneath his chin. His vocal cords vibrate in short staccato bursts, alerting me to his whimpering. I lean forward, my toes dangerously close to the muddy ridge. One misstep and I'll tumble in. It takes a moment for my brain to register what I'm seeing, and I think someone has discarded an old mannequin into the river. Then I realize this is no figure molded from fiberglass or plastic. This is no Halloween prank.
I see her pale against a tapestry of fall colors. With my heart slamming into my chest, I stumble backward. Though I try to break the fall with my hands, I hit the ground hard, my head striking the muddy earth, my teeth gnashing together, leaving me momentarily stunned. I blink up at the sky, trying to get my bearings, and in slow motion, a great blue heron, with a wingspan the length of a grown man, glides over me, casting a brief shadow. Slowly, I sit up, dazed, and my hands go to my scalp. When I pull my fingers away, they are bloody. Pinpricks of light dance in front of my eyes, and for a moment I'm blinded with shock, fear, dread. Then I do something I have never done, not even once at the sight of a dead body. I bend over and vomit, great violent heaves that leave my stomach hollow and my legs shaky. I wipe my mouth with the back of my hand. I know her, knew her. The dead woman is Gwen Locke, and at one time we were friends.
Thank you. Thank you.
Heather Gudenkauf reading from Not a Sound. And if you haven't read the book, and I don't think there are very many people here who haven't read the book, of course, that's Amelia Wynn, who is at the center of this book, and she is profoundly deaf. She has lost her hearing. She's been deaf for 2 years. At that point, she lost her hearing in a hit-and-run accident that may or may not have been an accident. And then here she stumbles across this friend who's been murdered, and her life takes some very dangerous and surprising turns from there on out. In the acknowledgments of the book, you describe this as your most personal novel. Why do you feel that way?
For me, it is my most personal novel to date. I've taken little pieces of my life and interwoven it in very fictionalized ways throughout the book. But I also have a hearing loss. I'm profoundly deaf in my left ear. And while I can hear, I've struggled over the years with hearing in noisy situations and classrooms, and I have a little bit of a sense of maybe some of what Amelia has gone through, but on a much different level. And I've always wanted to write a character who was deaf, and I was always really nervous to do that because it's such a big responsibility, a big undertaking, and I wanted to do it well and do it right. And so I spent quite a bit of time researching, as you can imagine.
Well, you do a lot of research for all of your novels. So how did you research what it was like to be deaf?
I did a lot of reading, as one does. I also interviewed quite a few people. My brother happens to be a doctor of audiology, and I spent some time talking with him. I visited with a local teacher who was a teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing. I had some early readers who are profoundly deaf, and they were able to give me some wonderful insights and kept me on the right path to make sure I was doing things correctly. I visited with some speech pathologists as well, and just really trying to learn some of the ins and outs, technically, what it might be to be a person who is deaf.
Well, and to lose your hearing as an adult, to live your entire life as a hearing person and then lose your hearing, I mean, that the heartache in your book that goes along with that, the just transformation of her life. But she feels so isolated, not being able to hear, but also trying to rebuild her life in this brand new way. When you were a child, did you find not having hearing in one ear, did you find that to be an isolating feeling?
Initially, we didn't know. It wasn't until I was school age that the hearing loss was discovered. And so I was one of those kids who was always 20 steps behind everybody else in the classroom, always nudging the person next to me, asking, what did the teacher say? And just really fell behind very early in school. So school was tough for me. And but when they did discover it and I did get hearing aids, I didn't realize how isolated I had been until, a whole new world was opened up for me with, you know, wonderful teachers who made accommodations and with the hearing aids. So it made a huge difference. But with my type of hearing loss, and I think with many with hearing loss,
being out and about and in classrooms and even socially can be exhausting because you spend so much time trying to hear and understand what people were saying. So I tended, and still do, tend to like to be on my own. Surprise, surprise, I love to read. I love being at home. I love being out in the woods hiking. But I do love connecting with people. It just can be challenging in certain situations.
Did you, and do you, have a fear, having a hearing impairment, do you have a fear of further hearing loss?
You know, I don't dwell on it, but and I do have a brother who's an audiologist, so he keeps reminding me, protect your hearing, turn down, you know, the iPod and when I'm listening or the iPad, and make sure you do take care of it because you don't know, and it is very precious. And with hearing, it's very, once you lose it, it's very challenging to correct that. So I don't dwell on it, but it does cross my mind.
Another way that this is a very personal novel is this is the first novel that, although you don't call it Dubuque, takes place in Dubuque and the surrounding area. Were there any nerves about that, knowing that the people that you mix with every day were going to recognize the places that you were describing and that it became very real?
One hopes that you get it right, absolutely. But I think that, you know, the places that I did pick out were pretty recognizable, I think. And I've done that with lots of my novels, I think, and many of them. In Little Mercies, there's a bookstore that is just a very thinly veiled description of our wonderful River Lights bookstore here in Dubuque. And I do it all the time. And so I love doing it. I love taking the places that are important to me and special to me and putting them into the novels in some way. I hope I get it right.
Another way that this is a very mm-hmm. personal novel to you, the main character works in a cancer clinic. Mm-hmm. And your son is a cancer survivor. How did that shape the writing of that part of the story? This is not, it's not a clinic I would want to go to. And we won't talk too much about that. I don't want to give anything away. But was there a struggle there? Because, I mean, obviously there are wonderful doctors, wonderful care, and your son is a survivor.
Yes. Yes. That piece of it with the clinic that you're speaking of is absolutely has nothing to do with my son's care. So
fictional, right?
Yes, very fictionalized. But in my research, I found that there were some places like that. Unfortunately, that wasn't our experience. We found a second home at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, the Children's Hospital there, while my son was being treated for osteosarcoma and couldn't have asked for better care. And that really is, you know, a story that he tells and his. But I, you know, when we have such profound incidences in our life, it kind of tends to creep out in other ways. And for me, it's in my writing. So I try to keep it as fictional as possible. But, you know, there's definitely the emotion surrounding cancer and having loved ones going through cancer. And in the novel, Amelia is a nurse, and our nurses were our godsends, you know, at the hospital and clinics as well. And I wanted that to come forth in the book as well. So while two very, my personal experience and the experiences in the novel, very different, I did want to highlight medical care and the importance of it.
Something that makes Amelia Wynn a particularly interesting character, I think, is, you know, so often when we read a novel, and she's really the heroine of the novel, but so often our heroes or heroines are very cut and dry. You know, they're good people, or, you know, and she's a flawed person. She has had some real struggles. She has had some real failures. And although we want to root for her, there are also times where you think it would be hard to be on her side. Was that important to you to make sure that she wasn't a cookie cutter heroine?
Yeah, it was. I think with all of us, we have our dark sides and our light sides and, you know, the ins and outs of life. We're at our best some days and other days we're not. And it was important for me to portray a character as realistically as I can. And she has had some rough times, Amelia has, and she hasn't always been her best self. And we're meeting her just when she's trying to find her way back to her best self. And she does well and she does poorly, just like we do each do in the days that we do have.
One of the things that I find makes your books so effective and sometimes really difficult to read is that the struggles that the people in your books encounter are so real. They're things that I do read about in the newspaper, I hear about on the radio. Often they could be ripped from the headlines. And that can be, you go to some really dark, ugly places. And that can be hard for a reader. What's it like for a writer to go there?
You know, it can be tough. I mean, there are certain books and scenes and books where it's hard to sit down some days. And when you know you have that really tough scene to write and you know that you need to do it well. And some days are easier than others. And I think what gets me through it, because, you know, there are some certain scenes in the books that are heart-wrenching. And I try and I really hope that I do that with each of my books. There's hope in the situations and in the ending. So we know that there's a light. People go through tough times every day. That's not unique to anybody. But how we react to them and how we, you know, look forward is what's important.
And I want to ask you to share with us what gave you the inspiration to really try writing a novel. It was something you'd wanted to do for a long time, right?
Yeah, I've been, of course, a reader first, always a reader first. But, you know, I'd been teaching for many years. My children were school age, and there was just something in the back of my mind that I could write a story, I write a book. And so there, and you've heard this story, so there.
But I want to hear it again.
Yes, so it's something that many teachers do. This is not anything that I created, but many teachers do. And I got the idea from another teacher that when I was teaching fourth and third grades over the years, we would end our day with this little chant. And I would start out to my third or fourth graders, have a good, and they'd pipe in night, and then watch out for cars, do your homework, read a book, dream big, and in our best Winston Churchill accent, never ever give up, and I can't wait to see you again. And we would do that every day, no matter what. So the horn could be, the buses could be honking their horns and getting snow pants on and boots on, but that's how we ended our day. And, you know, doing that day after day, year after year, I kind of began to realize that the dream big, never give up kind of thing wasn't just for my students, it was for me as well. And so one day that after school, got out for summer break, I bought a journal and I started writing my first novel, The Way to Silence, and finished the first draft before I got my classroom ready that fall. And the rest, they say, is history. So yeah, my students definitely were an inspiration.
When you published that first book, did you tell your students what the book was about?
No. I, and it was a long process. So yeah. It took about 3 years to eventually get to find a publisher. And by that time, I had moved out of the classroom. But I would, every once in a while, a former student will come to me and say, I read your book. And I'm like, oh, boy, how old are, does your mother know? This is the first thing. But it's always fun to catch up with former students.
Now, you're no longer working full-time at your day job.
Right.
So that answers part of the question. But a lot of people want to know how you find enough time to write. And so give me an idea of when you write. How do you approach it?
I don't have a set schedule with my writing, especially when my kids were younger. you know, I'd work around their schedules and the family schedule and work schedule, which was just fine. For me now, when I'm in the really working on a project, I have to spend as much time as possible. So I will get up early and write. I will write late. It's when I'm really working for a couple months really heavily into the project, I have to do something every single day with it. Otherwise, you lose that momentum. And so while I don't have a set schedule, it's just I know that I'll be working on it every day and, you know, almost every waking moment.
Heather Gudenkauf is the best-selling author of Not a Sound and a number of other suspense thrillers. She and I sat down in front of an audience at the Carnegie Stout Public Library in her hometown of Dubuque. We'll hear more from our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I recently sat down with best-selling author Heather Gudenkauf in front of an audience at the Carnegie Stout Public Library in Dubuque. We talked about her most recent novel, a suspense thriller called Not a Sound, and she answered questions from the audience. Here's more from our conversation.
Jane wants to know, where do you write?
You know, that is a great question. I am just recently an empty nester, so I have my three children have flown the coop and are off in the world, which is wonderful. So it's just my husband and I and Lolo, my dog. And you'd think I would have all this space to write and it would be great, but I find myself like, it's too quiet. It's much too quiet. So I do write at home, but I also love to go to little coffee shops around Dubuque. And I'll take my laptop and my earbuds, and I'll spend hours writing at some of those. And it's you can be quiet and have your own little space, but you also have your around people. So,
have you guys seen her doing this? Have you glimpsed her out there? You have to keep your eyes open.
Yes.
This is a question from Donna, and it's a great question as both an educator and a writer and a mom. Her question is, how can we assure that we grow future authors? What can parents, teachers, and communities do to encourage the art of writing and storytelling? Wow,
that is such a fabulous, fabulous question. You know, I think for me, growing up, you know, my parents were working parents. They were very busy. They didn't have a lot of time to read to me, but there were always books. We always were surrounded by books, and if we didn't have books, we had a way to get to the library. Either we took the little city bus or my dad would take us to the library on weekends. So that's huge. Just, and my parents were readers. So seeing them read, I think, is very important. And it doesn't matter what it is, magazines or books, just seeing your child seeing you read is really important. And I think, you know, the art of storytelling is something that needs to be preserved. And I think with today's society, we're very plugged in. It's easy to sit around at home and be looking at our devices and not talking and hearing the stories of our parents and our grandparents. And I think that is something that if people really make a conscious effort to preserve, will really go a long way to making more storytellers.
Deed in from Cascade wants to know, what has brought you the most joy when writing?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. So for me, really getting lost in the story, just like I do when I'm reading a good book, if I can get lost in the story I'm trying to tell, that doesn't always happen. But when it does happen, you know, you're doing something right. And when the characters surprise me, because sometimes I might have the whole novel planned out in my head, but the characters will take me off in a different direction.
How does that happen? Tell me what happens when.
Yeah, it's hard to explain, but you know, I have my plan and I start typing from one character's point of view, and all of a sudden they turn right and they're supposed to go left, and it really there's just snowballs into a completely different
tangent, and it's really hard to explain, and I've talked with fellow authors about that, and it is really difficult to put into words, but sometimes they just take over.
How much revising do you have to do? I mean, you, well, first of all, do you start with an outline? Is it all plotted out? You're saying that sometimes they go the wrong direction. Do you have that roadmap there?
With each novel, it's been very different for me. I've tried every which way in my writing, and sometimes I plan it out and sometimes I don't. For the novel that I just finished, that I just turned in, I really did plot it out. And there's some real benefits to that. It's much more efficient. I didn't write myself into as many corners as I usually do. For me, I do have to edit quite a bit and revise. When I first sit down with a project, I just get it all out on paper, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And then I have to
On paper. Do you actually write by hand or you
I always start out by hand.
Really?
I always start my novels longhand. I'll buy a notebook or a journal, and it's not very efficient, so I don't spend as much time as I'd like to doing that. But then I transfer it over to computer. And so once I get it all down on paper, then I start tearing it apart, and having early readers help me with that as well, and really digging in. So I do a lot of revision and rewriting and throwing things out and putting things back in. For Not a Sound, I was halfway through the novel when the villain changed. It just wasn't working with who I had in mind as the villain, wasn't working, and had to go back and rewrite a whole lot, but it worked better.
So all, you have to go back and change all the foreshadowing and
yes.
hints and clues. And
yeah, and it's all part of that, kind of putting that puzzle together, which is enjoyable for the most part, sometimes.
So you just turned a novel in. Can you give us a hint?
I can give you a little bit of a hint, because there's still going to be some revision and editing to be done. But it is, once again, set in small town Iowa, a railroad town. And it's the story of three preteen girls, best friends, who go into a train yard one night. And two come out perfectly okay and one does not. And it's told from the point of view of the journal of one of the girls, from one of the parents of the girls, a grandparent, and from a psychiatrist who's involved. And so,
many different narrators.
So I'm kind of going back to some of the format I used for some of my earlier novels. So that's tentatively titled There Will Be Scars. But if you know me and have heard me before, my titles always get changed. So,
by your editor or by you?
It's really a collaboration. So we'll get to our conversation about titles, and it never is one that I pick. So I'm not good at titles. So we'll see if this one sticks.
You mentioned you do a lot of reading. A lot of people ask you to read their books. So are you reading a lot of new work or even unpublished work?
I do. I do get requests to read advanced reading copies, or galleys, they're called. And I just finished a fabulous one by a debut author called It Ends With Her, which I don't know when it's coming out, but it is amazing. It was fabulous. And I do. I love to read new-to-me authors. I love to read debut authors because it wasn't that long ago that was me. And I remember that feeling of hoping, wishing somebody who was more established would take the time to read my novel. And fortunately, I did have some very kind and generous authors give my books a read. So I really try to repay that.
So when people are asking you to read their work, are they asking for feedback? Are they asking for a jacket blurb or what?
Yeah, that both usually in some way. And, you know, if it's something that I really enjoy, I will be happy to offer a quote for the novel. Yeah.
Beth from Asbury wants to know what advice you would give to aspiring writers.
I always tell people or folks who want to be writers to read. You know, that's the number one. Read deep and wide and far and as much as you can.
And also, you know, just to sit down and do it. I think for me, I thought about writing a long time before I did it. And you just have to make that commitment to yourself to sit down and do it and not worry too much about the end product that will come. But find something, a story that you want to tell. Sit down and just get it all out on paper. You can always go back. But I think we're our own worst critics at times, and that can trip us up once in a while. And to try and put that self-critic aside for a while and just to really enjoy the writing and get it out on paper.
Well, so many of us psych ourselves out, mm-hmm. and we get writer's block. Yeah. Do you get writer's block?
I do. There's sometimes that the words just aren't flowing, and I will go for a hike. I'll put Lolo in the car, and we'll head to Swiss Valley or the mines of Spain, and that really seems to help me. It jogs some ideas just gets things moving again as far as ideas. I'll also return to handwriting. Whatever project I'm working on, that's getting that my hand to the paper on a pen and touching the paper really seems to make a difference for me for some reason. So when I get in sticky situations, I'll turn to that.
Kathy has a question about book clubs. And first of all, do you belong to a book club?
I sort of belong to a book club. I'm the worst member ever. I want to be in every book club, but I have gone to some book clubs as a reader, and I do love it, and it's that whole time factor. But I love book clubs, and I love visiting with book clubs.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Kathy's question was, how do you select the books you're going to discuss? Mm-hmm. But if you're the worst member...
I am the worst member. they don't ask me my opinion, because it's hit or miss. So
I doubt you're the very worst member. A lot of members don't read them at all. I'm just here for the wine.
It's... Yeah. Yes. So,
but you try to make your books, or at least you try to be very friendly to book clubs.
Oh, sure. Yes. Yeah. I love talking about books. So I can, sitting next to somebody on a bus or anything, I would talk to them about books. And, or if I see somebody with a book that I've read, I'll absolutely talk to them about it. So I do love discussing books. And I guess I do have a little book club with my family. My mom and my sisters, we read a lot of the same things. So we're always talking books. So yeah.
So when you visit with a book club, because occasionally you are a guest at a book club, they've read your book. What's that like to have, an intense audience with a small group of people who has devoured your book and wants to ask you little tiny questions about it? Yeah, what's that like?
It is a lot of fun, and I do enjoy it, and they don't always like with the characters, they don't always like the characters, and it's always fun to hear that perspective from the reader to say, well, this character drove me crazy and this is why. And that's always fun to hear, and it's always interesting to hear readers' takes on the books and the novels.
Yeah, does it make you help you see your work in a different light?
It does, and most of the time it's good. Sometimes maybe not. But it's always enlightening. Yeah.
So what do you think you've learned from that?
I've learned that it's very important to know what you're talking about when you're writing, because if you make a mistake, someone will will notice it. And that I encourage that. It's good. I learned, I think in the novel I called the paddleboard paddle an oar. And if you're a paddleboarder, that's a no-no. It's not an oar. It's a paddle. And it's an important equipment, piece of equipment. So things like that. And of course, hearing other people's take on, certain issues that are in the news, because my books do talk about a lot about some social issues, and to hear the different perspectives that might match mine, but might not match mine. It's always really interesting.
Well, there you love details. Your books are all very detailed and very believable. I mean, one of the things in this novel, Amelia has a dog, and it's her hearing assistance dog, but it was trained in Europe, and it speaks Czech.
Yes. So, so how did that happen, right? So I was listening to a podcast, and it talked about
training police dogs. And some of what Stitch's backstory didn't make it into the novel, and I'll have to put
that. He has to have his own novel.
Yeah. I think he does, but I think I need to put that out there and social media a little bit more about Stitch, because there's whole sections taken out. But he was trained by someone who trains police dogs, and I did learn through a podcast that oftentimes another language is used in training the police dogs, and Chuck happened to be the one that Stitch was trained in. So that was really interesting to learn about and try and figure out how that would work for
her. Has anybody been critiquing your check?
No, thank goodness, because I'm sure they could. So
it's so interesting, because right now, I mean, obviously the book came out during the summer, but you're still selling this book. Mm-hmm. You just turned in another novel. You're reading all these books. And are you already working on a new project?
I am not.
You're not?
Not yet. I'm working on my proposals. So typically what I'll do is I will think of 4 or 5 different ideas for my next novel, and I will run those by my editor, and together we'll sift through them and decide which will be the next project that I'll spend, you know, a good year on. And so it's always a fun kind of nerve-wracking time, because you know that you're going to be living within this story for the next several months.
Well, and giving anyone else control over that must be a little bit hard, because you must have your favorites.
Absolutely. That, you know, and it's such a great collaborative relationship I do have with my editor, and I'm very fortunate with that we are able to talk it through, and I thoroughly value her opinion. So we, in the end, we're both happy. Yeah.
Now, readers in Iowa love that your books take place in Iowa, and there's so many touchdowns for us. But of course, you have readers everywhere. Mm-hmm. You spread the gospel of taco pizza in this novel. What do you hope? Your books are not, you know, boosting Iowa. That's not your intention to spread the word. But what do you hope readers learn about our state when they read your books?
Yeah, I do think Iowa is beautiful. It is a beautiful state. And, you know, I think outside of our state, sometimes people think it's very flat and boring, and it's not. I mean, and even that is beautiful in my mind. So, you know, I do go around, and I do talk a lot about Iowa and how beautiful it is, with our rivers and bluffs and our woods and the cornfields, all of it. And so I do want readers to take that away. But also, you know, there's something about Iowa nice. You know, even though that we do have, of course, in my novels, some pretty bad things happen. There's just really good people here. And I think that comes through in my novels, too.
Well, Heather Gudenkauf, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Heather Gudenkauf is the best-selling author of Not a Sound and a number of other suspense thrillers. She and I sat down in front of an audience at the Carnegie Stout Public Library in her hometown of Dubuque. A big thank you to Michael May of the Carnegie Stout Public Library for making this possible, engineer Jim Davies, and Iowa Public Radio producer Ben Stanton. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.